chug, 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 chug.
Hello and welcome back to the Wizard Staff. I'm your host Guy.
And I'm Blake.
And we are two drunk novices who like to talk about EDH. We drink and swear, so you've been warned. Please drink responsibly when you're talking about children's card games. We are back for our motherfucking part two of Kaldheim. Sorry.
Kaldheim.
God damn it.
We're going to be going over the best cards to include in your 99. And yeah, just talking about some of those new mechanics. We just did our part one. Feeling pretty good. Drinking some alcohol. You know how it is. So, Blake, what are you drinking?
So, I started a new beer from part one. I am drinking Two Towns Cider House. It is a Pacific pineapple cider. I just thought it was something that's unique. It is very, very fruity. And, you know, I saw a tree on the logo, and I'm like, tree? Kaldheim, the world tree, it's perfect.
All right, pretty nice on flavor. I'm continuing to drink my Scorpion Bowl IPA, and it's still upside down. I will say, because we are talking about Kaldheim, and it is one of the main sets of the year, one of the main four, we should be getting news soon from the Rules Committee about some cards, about whether or not they were banned or unbanned. And by the time that this episode was released, we'll already have heard the news. So I'm just going to give two general impressions. One, nothing happened and, you know, life goes on. Or two, something really crazy happened and it's like, whoa, oh my god, something crazy happened.
There is no in between. It is only the extremes.
Yeah, and so Blake and I may have to then put out an episode, and maybe it'll be in between this, just because we'll try and stay relevant.
I don't think so.
Anyway, so we're going to just quickly go over some of those new mechanics that we just talked about in our last episode. So we do see the return of the modal double-faced cards. However, those were only on the gods in part one.
And the pathways.
So we won't be talking about... Well, yeah, the pathways, but... We've already seen pathways before, and, you know, we already kind of gave our general impressions of them. We do have Changeling, which is a returning creature type that makes that creature every type of creature. And then we have the two mechanics that are specific to Kaldheim. We have Foretell. So during your turn, you may pay 2 mana and exile a card with Foretell from your hand face down. You may cast it on a later turn for its Foretell cost. Each card with Foretell has a Raven Watermark. Then we have Boast, which adds a drawback to an activated ability, which is referred to as the Boast ability. So the drawback is a player can only activate the Boast ability after a creature with the ability attacks, and at most once each turn. So between the two, I like Foretell a lot more, because it's interesting because it can kind of give you a pseudo larger hand size, because you can foretell those cards away earlier on in the game and you still have access to them. And it's nice because you're also, in almost every case but one, you make a card cheaper over several turns, which is great as well. You can foretell at instant speed, so if someone's like, let me see your hand, you could say in response, I'm going to foretell those. Oh wait, no. You could only foretell on your turn. So if someone were to do something where they could see your hand on your turn, like if they could taxi and probe you or whatever, you could then respond and say, like, I'm going to foretell a card so you can't see it. Mm-hmm. Or like with Necropotence, when you go to discard cards, and instead of like discarding those cards to then have them exiled, you could foretell them before that happens.
Alright.
Yeah. And then Boast is just very thematic with the set. I think the downside is just not a lot of Boast creatures have haste, so you need to keep the creature around, and depending on the effect, it just could become a target. So just keep that in mind. If you are going to be building a boast deck, try and grant your creatures haste, so you can just try and get the ability to go off as soon as possible.
Right, otherwise they have to last an entire rotation of the table.
Right. Alright. So, now we're going to go into the 99. There aren't any notable reprints.
So you better see some later in the year.
Yeah, I think in like other sets that care more about reprints, like the Time Spiral Remastered, we'll get here in the next month or so. We'll have a lot of reprints that we would like to see.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of cycles, we have quite a few cycles. So we do have Snow Basics. They have a new frame and new artwork. I think each land type has two different arts, so that's pretty cool. And again, the more access we have to Snow, the more likely we're going to see it being played.
Mm-hmm.
We did get dual Snowlands, but not like the original Snowlands, because these will enter the battlefield tapped. But they are still fetchable, and are Snow permanents, so it is relevant.
So I think if you're on a budget, these are actually nice.
Yeah, because you can always, you know, if you don't have any kind of like reactive play, you can always like include these in your deck, and then if you have like a fetch land or something, crack it, get this Snow fetch land to enter the battlefield right before your untap step, so it's like not really doing you any bad. Yeah, I'd say like worth it in most cases. Alright, and then we did have 10 realm lands, as Blake likes to call them.
I don't know what to call them. I think that's like the best name for them, considering each one of them is by name associated with each realm. So I'm just calling them realm lands. I'm sure there's some other name for them.
No, I think that's a pretty good name. They all enter the battlefield tapped. They all have a first tap ability. There's two for each color where it'll just add like a white mana, a blue mana, a red mana, whatever. And then you have the 10 pairings, so you would then have like some kind of like mana cost, like for example Axeguard Armory, which is one red white tap, and then you sacrifice it and then you get some kind of ability.
Right.
But they're all mediocre, so we're not really going to talk about any of them.
Yeah.
We do see the introduction of Runes, which is an enchantment type that will draw a card on ETB and can enchant a creature or artifact.
Well, they can enchant any permanent, but if they're a creature or equipment, then those cards get like a keyword or they grant a keyword. Honestly, like none of them are really worth talking about, but they are kind of interesting in terms of design.
Now, we do have the Return of Sagas again. We did get to see this return back last year with Theros. And what's cool this time, though, is all the sagas that we are seeing are multicolor.
Right.
Yeah. So there's 20 of them. We're only going to talk about two, and we're just going to talk about them now. And I'll do the first one. So, Showdown of the Skalds, 2 red, white. So as this enters the battlefield, and after your draw step, you would then add a lore counter, and then you sacrifice after the third effect's gone off. So, exile the top 4 cards of your library. This is the first effect. Until the end of your next turn, you may play those cards. Then for step 2 and step 3, whenever you cast a spell this turn, put a +1/+1 counter on target creature you control. So, there is a card called Concentrate, which is a 2 blue-blue card that draws 3 cards. So, for the same amount of mana, you exile 4 cards, and you can play them up until the next turn, which is something that Red's been able to do in its impulsive draw. So, in a way, this is pretty good card advantage for Boros, which is definitely worth thinking about including into most Boros decks, because that's something that has been kind of one of their weaknesses since the beginning of time.
Since the dawn of time, since the creation of man, Boros has never known card advantage.
Yeah. I mean, Blake, you have a Boros deck. Don't you think you would want to include this?
Perhaps. Like, I don't know, like, if they just keep printing more and more wheels, I might just go with wheels, but if they don't, if they're like, oh, we can't possibly print more wheels, then yeah, I might just have to go with Showdown of Scalds.
Okay.
All right. And then our other saga we have is King Narfi's Betrayal. 1 blue, black. Again, it's a saga. So, lore counter 1. Each player mills 4 cards. Then you may exile a creature or planeswalker card from each graveyard. 2 and 3. Until end of turn, you may cast spells from among cards exiled with King of Narfi's Betrayal. And you may spend mana as though it were mana of any color to cast those spells. Guy, do you want to take a minute to explain exactly how this card works? Because that was a big confusion when I first read it.
Sure. And I'm going to do the best here because I am drunk. So, it ETBs, and each player, including yourself, mills 4 cards. So at the very least, there's 4 cards in everyone's graveyard if no other card was put into the graveyard early. So, among those graveyards now, you get to exile a creature or a planeswalker card from each of the graveyards. So, at most, you can then exile up to 4 cards. Then, for the next 2 turns, you could cast one of those creatures or planeswalkers from exile and spend mana as though it were mana of any color to cast those spells. So, kind of nice. It's a way of, again, it's another good impulsive draw, or just having like card advantage without it being direct, just drawing cards.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's okay. For mill decks, it seems kind of relevant.
I gotta be honest, every time I look at the art, I think like it's like Thanos' chin, and I'm just like, I'm so distracted.
You know, you're not wrong to think that.
All right. So next we have the Mythic Cycle, which I believe is the last cycle we're going to talk about before we talk about individual cards. So again, we're going to go in Wooburg order: white, blue, black, red, green, multicolor, then colorless. So we have the White Mythic, Starnheim Unleashed, 2 white, sorcery. Create a 4/4 white angel warrior creature token with flying and vigilance. If this spell was foretold, create X of those creature tokens instead. And then the foretell is XX white. What do you think, Guy?
This is a slightly better Decree of Justice, in my opinion. I am getting a little tired of how white mythics are just creating 4/4 angels, but at least this one can just be tucked away and grows at a better exponential rate. So, in a way, it's still better than Decree of Justice, because I think that was like XX 2 white to cycle.
It's very similar.
Yeah, I guess like that would draw you a card, but I don't know. I think that's just like a low kind of... I guess that is like one benefit to that, but I think more times you would rather want to play this. And I think this card you would only want to foretell. I don't think that this is particularly good otherwise.
I guess maybe I can ask this now, or maybe ask on each individual card. Should all of these foretell cycles only be cast for their foretell cost?
This one, definitely. I think we can go but case by case.
Okay, we'll do that then.
Alright, so next is Alron's Epiphany, 5 blue, blue. Create 2/1/1 blue bird creatures tokens with flying. Take an extra turn after this one. Exile Alron's Epiphany. And then its foretell cost is 4 blue, blue. So it's only going to cost you 1 less.
Okay. So we're obviously playing this card because we want those 2/1/1 bird creature tokens, right? No, okay, I'm just joking with you. Because, like, this is just another extra turn spell. So, like, all those extra turn decks are very happy. And I'm glad that this one exiles itself, because some of the most powerful extra turn effects are ones that either go to the grave, where they're easily recurrable, or they shuffle themselves back into the library, which actually isn't much of a downside and can very easily be, like, searched out and, like, cast again and again and do infinite extra turns. So I'm glad that this one exiles itself. Because I hope after, like, Nexus of Fate had to be banned in, like, Pioneer and Historic, like, Wizards of the Coast has, like, learned their lesson to, like, always make sure their extra turn spells exile themselves. I don't know. Maybe I just am expecting too much from Wizards. Maybe they're not going to do that. Who knows?
No, I think that's a fair call out. And this one in particular, because it exiles itself, I don't think it's going to see too much play. I do think that this will be a budget friendly, because I can't see this costing that much, a budget friendly extra turn spell, because a lot of times, like Time Warp or Temporal Manipulation, some of the better ones do still cost you like kind of a pretty penny. So this one at least I can expect to be costing a little less.
Yeah, I agree that it will monetarily like be more affordable than other extra turn spells because it's less powerful. However, I do think it will see a decent amount of play in extra turn decks because they really want a critical mass of extra turn spells, and they just want like as many as possible to like be as consistent as possible. That being said, you know, if you've played Commander for any amount of time, extra turn decks are generally not very popular. Personally speaking, they're one of my least favorite decks to play against because they often just take like 20 minute turns and just kind of feel like they're wasting my time. That being said, I have played against extra turn decks that I did not get annoyed by because they basically like demonstrated that they could take like 20 extra turns in a single turn that they made all those copies. So like there is some wiggle room, just kind of be cautious.
Yeah, I think that's fair. So I do think that this one doesn't have a huge upside or downside to whether or not you're going to cast it from being foretold or from your hand. So this one, like if you, I guess, just foretell it, you're only saving one mana. Doesn't seem like a huge upside to me.
Yeah.
Let's move on.
We have Haunting Voyage, 4 black black sorcery. Choose a creature type. Return up to 2 creature cards of that type from your graveyard to the battlefield. If this spell was foretold, return all creature cards of that type from your graveyard to the battlefield instead. And then its foretell cost is 5 black black. So it is even more to foretell it than to just cast it. That's a little bit different.
Yes, it is the only foretell card that costs more to be foretold. And so in thinking about like how much this would cost you 2 to foretell it, and then 5 to be foretold. So in total, it's 7 black black. So it is quite a hefty cost. I do think that this is pretty good in tribal heavy decks, where you're going to want to get as many cards out of the graveyard of one creature type as possible. However, this does seem like a case-by-case kind of thing, where you just kind of have to read the situation of when you want to cast this. Because if you think about like your typical reanimation spell, 4 black black to get 2 creatures back isn't the best deal. But 5 black black once it's foretold, that seems better if you are getting, I'd say, it's probably worth it if you get like 5 creatures back.
Right.
Yeah, this one, I don't know. It's like this one is also okay, and I think it really will only see play in a lot of tribal decks, and if you are playing it correctly.
Yeah, I will say that the closest comparison to any other card would be Patriarch's Bidding in terms of its effect, and Patriarch's Bidding is about $20. And I suspect that this will be a much more affordable option if you're wanting to buy that card, but like it's outside of your budget. This is much more budget friendly.
Yeah, definitely. Alright, now we're going to talk about one of my favorite cards, Quakebringer. 3. Red, red. Creature, giant berserker. Your opponents gain life. You'll love to see it, baby. And at the beginning of your upkeep, Quakebringer deals 2 damage to each opponent. You'll love to see it. This ability triggers only if Quakebringer is on the battlefield or if Quakebringer is in your graveyard and you control a giant. Then its foretell cost is 2 red, red, 5/4. Just to quickly mention, Haunting Voyage, since it's so specific to tribal heavy decks and the situation, I don't know if it's worth it to cast it as is or if it's being foretold. I think in more times you're actually going to want to just cast it to get the 2 creatures instead, because it's just so hard to kind of like evaluate whether or not you are going to get all the creatures back from your graveyard. So, because you have to have kind of like a setup for that. So, that's my opinion. But now, Quakebringer. So, this is like a mini Purphoros, which I'm already in love with. Because you can't gain life, which is very relevant to my deck specifically, because I don't want you to gain life. You're dealing 2 damage to your opponents if this is on the field, which is relevant, because you're always just trying to deal more damage. It is a little confusing because it will trigger if there is a giant on the field and this is in the graveyard, but otherwise it will only trigger if this is on the field. So that's kind of the best way to think about it. Though honestly, I'm a little disappointed that, kind of like Allrun's Epiphany, this card is only 1 less when you foretell it. Though I guess, like, if this were in my opening hand, I'd be really tempted to just try and, like, foretell this earlier. Yeah, it'll be interesting to kind of, like, play around with this card. I like it because, again, your opponents can't gain life. It's kind of relevant in that way. And just dealing 2 damage every turn is pretty good. Yeah, I think it, in my specific scenario, I like it a lot. But I don't think, like, you know, this will be, like, a red staple by any means.
Okay, like it's a more of a niche card, but for you personally, you really like it because you can like maybe put it in your Purphoros deck?
Yes, yes.
Okay, so for me, like this is like the key line of text on this card is the fact that it says your opponents can't gain life, which there's only about a dozen cards that have that effect, so it's nice for that reason.
Well, there's about a dozen cards that say you can't gain life, but there's even less cards where it's like your opponents gain life. Because this, and it doesn't matter to me so much that I'm trying to gain life, but
yeah,
that is an important distinction, is that it's just specifically your opponents can't gain life.
Okay, that is true. Okay, I hadn't really thought about that. Okay.
It doesn't matter in my situation, but I think in other situations it would matter.
Okay. I am kind of curious, because like the last time we kind of got this kind of effect, it was where like your opponents couldn't gain life and it dealt a little bit of damage to your opponents, was I believe Roiling Vortex, which was in our Zendikar Rising set review. And I'm just kind of curious how you feel about Quakebringer versus Roiling Vortex for your Purphoros deck.
Well, if I had to pick between the two, I think I would actually pick Roiling Vortex over this. Mainly because it is a cheaper card, and I can turn the can't gain life on and off whenever I want.
Mm-hmm.
And it deals 5 damage when people are cheating cards into play, which is actually kind of relevant in Commander. But for consistency's sake, because I think the biggest downside to the Purphoros deck is that players are trying to gain life, I am just trying to run. I think I run every single mono red card that says can't gain life, except for Witch Hunt. I just found that that's like a little too slow for me, being at 5 mana. But this being at 5 mana and a creature, so it'll ETB, trigger, Purphoros, and it also deals damage on itself, is a little more relevant to each of my opponents. So I like it.
Right, I was wondering about that.
And being able to foretell it is also important. No, I like this. I'm going to include this It could be an easy cut just because it costs more and like the foretell probably won't be that relevant. And I don't run any giant tribal synergies.
That's fine.
And it's probably not like it is fine, but like if I had more giants, like this, like maybe if there are more giants that are being printed over time, this card will just become more relevant to me. But right now, that giant part where it's like deal 2 damage if this is in the graveyard, just I don't care.
This next card, I know, Guy, you and I have been alternating between reading cards, but I feel like you have much stronger opinions about this next card, so why don't you read it?
Oh. Well, okay. It's Battle Mammoth, and it's 3 green green, creature, elephant, trample. Whenever a permanent you control becomes the target of a spell or an ability an opponent controls, you may draw a card. And its foretell cost is 2 green green. And it's a 6/5. I don't like this just because I feel like the ability to draw a card when a permanent you control becomes the target of a spell doesn't feel like it is a green ability, because green should be drawing cards when it's relevant to like creature's power and toughness, because it already has so many ways of getting more lands into play and just drawing cards in general. So it feels weird to me, and I know that we've seen this on other effects before, but I don't know, like I want this effect to be like, I hate to say it, but I want it to be shifted into white just because I think it's like a taxing kind of effect, where if a card you control is about to be targeted by something, you want to then draw a card to at least incentivize people to say like whether or not you want that to be targeted. So I don't know. I don't think Battle Mammoth though is going to see much play in EDH, so it's just not relevant to talk about as much.
But from a design perspective, you still want to talk about it.
Yeah, I don't think it'll see much play in EDH. I was just disappointed in general, and since we're just talking about the Mythic Foretell in general, it's just worth noting.
So to clarify, would you feel more comfortable with this card if it said whenever a creature you control becomes the target of spell or ability your opponent controls, draw
a
card?
Yeah, because it's... Maybe. Just because green's drawing is often tied to creature's power. Like, there are cards where it's like, if you control a creature with power 4 or more, draw a card. Or whenever a creature with power 4 or more enters the battlefield, draw a card. So, those are the ways that green is often drawing, like, directly drawing cards. Or, there are cards like, you know, your Cultivate or Kodama's Reach, which go get you specific lands that are already tutoring and getting you ahead of the curve that way. So I don't know. Battle Mammoth just seems weird. I'm sure it will be more relevant in other formats, but that we're not a podcast about other formats. We're a podcast about Commander.
Since its ability is basically half of Leovold, Emissary of Trest, which is banned, like, this card clearly needs to be banned, right?
Well, I mean, yeah. Like, if we could just ban it, sure. Like,
no, stop it. Someone's going to take you seriously.
Alright, let's talk about, you know, the 99 cards. Let's get into some monocolor. Let's start with white.
We're done with the cycle now. We're actually going to talk about white cards. Alright! Search for Glory. 2 and a white. Snow Sorcery. Search your library for a snow permanent card, a legendary card, or a saga card. Reveal it, put it into your hand, then shuffle your library. You gain 1 life for each snow mana spent to cast this spell. So, I need to talk about this card. So here's the deal. If you want access to an important snow, legendary, or saga card every game, then run this card. If you don't run this card. It's that simple. Don't overthink it. Like, as time passes, as more and more cards get made, there's not going to be as many snow cards, because again, snow is highly tied towards only a few sets of Magic. However, there's going to be more and more legendary cards created, just because of Commander and just legendary as a super type in general. There's also going to be more and more sagas created every single set. So I think as time progresses, this card gets better as more and more legendaries and sagas get made. I think one of the notable things about this card is that you can get cards like Gaia's Cradle or Sarah's Sanctum, because it says legendary card. It doesn't say legendary creature. It says legendary card. So you can get really powerful legendaries like those lands, or you could also get really powerful legendary creatures like Limvala, Keeper of Silence, because you cast Search for Glory on turn 3, search up your Limvala, cast Limvala, Keeper of Silence on turn 4. You could do something like that. So, don't overthink this card, folks. Like, I see a lot of people who are super polarized on this card, people who are calling it trash, people who are, like, overhyping this to the moon. Just, it's not that complicated.
This card's probably in the middle for me, honestly.
Exactly.
And I personally will run it probably in Avacyn, because the more I think about it, there are quite a few legendary targets in my deck where I could go grab them. Like, especially with the addition of Redain, who we talked about in our last set, you know, cast this, go find that. Or, you know, if I just am stuck for a land, I can go find a snow land, because I run snow cards in that deck.
I don't know, like, we can talk about this, but I don't feel like using this card, 3-mana sorcery, to fetch up a land to hand is good enough. Like, I know, like, mono white is starred for ramp, but I'm not sure that's good enough.
It's not great, but I think it's fine in desperate situations.
Okay.
Because then you shuffle your library. And the other just important thing to note, I don't know how many cards we're going to talk about that are like this. It is a snow sorcery. That doesn't mean you need to cast it with snow, but you do get the additional benefit if it is kind of spent with snow. That's how these snow instances sorceries have worked. They don't have to be cast with snow, but you will get an additional benefit.
Yes, yes.
Okay. Glorious Protector. 2 white-white, creature, angel, cleric, flash, flying. When it enters the battlefield, you may exile any number of non-angel creatures you control until Glorious Protector leaves the battlefield. And then it also has Foretell for 2 and a white. And it's a 3/4. So this is good in decks that have a lot of non-angel creatures that are prone to board wipes, like Damnation, Wrath of God. Or even like Cyclonic Rift. Cyclonic Rift especially being good, since then this can get like bounced back to your hand, and then you can just have all your creatures re-enter the battlefield. It won't save everything, like your enchantments and artifacts, but I think this is kind of good for white decks that really want that. It reminds me, I think I talked about this card a lot, because I was like, yeah, no, I can see this being played, is Mandate of Peace, which came out in Commander 2019. And I was like, yeah, this is going to be great, because it'll be good against Cyclonic Rift. And then nobody played it. So, I don't want to say, like, this is going to be now the solution, but I do think that you could keep this in mind, and it might help.
I agree. I think it's a great way to get around board wipe effects. And the fact that this has flash, the fact that this can be played at instant speed, and it's relatively affordable to cast, makes it actually like halfway decent. Yeah.
Sure.
Alright, next up is Doomscar. 3 white-white sorcery, destroy all creatures, but then you can foretell it for 1 white-white. So, there's been a little bit of discussion around this card, actually a fair amount of discussion around this card, because you can, on turn 2, foretell it, and then turn 3, cast it, and destroy all creatures, and that's in comparison to Wrath of God, which is kind of like the benchmark for all board wipe effects, which is just a 4 CMC destroy all creatures. And Guy, as someone who's played much more mono white than I have, I'm kind of curious what your opinion is of this card.
Trash. I don't like it.
Really?
You asked me before the podcast, and I've gotten to think about it a little. I don't think the foretelling is really that great, because, like, that's kind of like, you know, the one upside to this is that you can foretell it for later. I think Wrath of God is just your best Wrath effect in general. And this isn't really going to replace that. I think the way to make Wraths just better in general for Mono White would be to make them at instant speed. But...
Oh, God.
That's also, like, tricky, because I think that's, like, really powerful.
Yeah, I can't imagine them ever doing that, to be honest. I'm sorry, Guy. I can't imagine WotC ever making an instant speed Wrath.
Yeah, and we actually got Shatter of the Sky last year, which wasn't instant speed, but did allow you to draw a card.
Every player. Not just you. Every player.
Yeah. But I think that was still a better way of, like, trying to experiment with Wraths than what this is. I don't like this card that much. I won't include it.
Alright, the last white card we have is Starnhelm Courser. 2 and white, creature Pegasus 2/2 with flying. Artifacts and enchantment spells you cast cost 1 less to cast. So, this is nice, particularly in artifact combo decks, because reducing the cost of your artifacts is actually pretty relevant. We're starting to gain a critical mass of them, including Cloud Key, Ethereum Sculptor, Foundry Inspector, Joyous Familiar, and now this. Less important, so, is the fact that this does synergize with enchantment decks. Like, so far we've had Herald of the Pantheon and Starfield Mystic, which have just made your enchantment spells cost 1 less, and now we also have this card. So, again, cycling back, I think just there's so many artifact combos that this aids that I think that that's where this card will really shine.
I think you care about this a lot more for those reasons, but this card I was just kind of like meh on. I know White does, though, care a lot about artifact enchantments, and so this is kind of nice where it's not ramping you, but it is kind of making them cost less. So that's cool, but overall I do think it's not going to be like a mono white staple in any means.
I mean, in a way you can think of cost reduction as a form of ramp. Would you agree?
No, I agree with that. It's just being so specific, I guess, to artifact and enchantments, like, it's okay.
Okay.
Alright, next we have Raven Form, which is 2 and a blue, sorcery. Exile target artifact or creature. Its controller creates a 1/1 blue bird creature token with flying. And then its foretell cost is blue. So, this is weird because it's exiling target artifact or creature, which has often been something that we have seen a lot in white. It is a sorcery, so it's not nearly as good as like some of those other like creature removals. But I think it's weird.
Yeah, for like 4 days, the internet was kind of like blowing up about this card, about the fact that blue typically does not have the ability to exile target artifact. Like, people are asking, like, is this just now going to become a mono blue staple? The fact that mono blue can't exile artifacts or get rid of them, is this now just a staple? Sort of like how Feed the Swarm became a staple for mono black decks. People were kind of asking that question a lot, and Mark Rosewater, the like lead designer at Wizards of the Coast, has said that this card does not set precedent. We are likely not going to see this kind of effect in future sets. So this was just kind of one of those cards that made everyone panic for like 4 days, and then it quickly died down. I saw at the time a lot of people comparing this card to Pongify or Rapid Hybridization, but I think a much better comparison would be Reality Shift or the fairly new Amphibian Mutineer. That's just like a mild critique I have, which is people were comparing it to cards, which is like, compare it to other cards. There's much better cards to compare this to.
Yeah. I think in mono blue cases, this might be not a staple, but something just to run as like targeted removal. But other than that, if you're running, you know, any two-color deck, I don't think that you're likely to be running this.
Yeah. In my opinion, I don't actually think mono-blue decks are going to run this because, again, it's 3 CMC and it's sorcery speed. Like, until we get, like, something that's, like, instant speed and costs less mana, I don't think mono-blue decks are actually going to play this. And I think that might be a long time since Maro said we're not going to get this every set.
All right. What's next?
Ooh, I'm excited about this next card. It is Mystic Reflection. It is 1 and a blue, instant. Choose target non-legendary creature. The next time one or more creatures or planeswalkers enters the battlefield this turn, they enter as copies of the chosen creature, and then it has a foretell cost of a single blue mana. Wow. So, this is one of those cards, one of the few cards that CEDH players are actually talking about, because it can copy Dockside Extortionist, which is just probably one of the most busted cards, and it can turn your opponent's commander into a relatively useless creature permanently. Like, say they go to cast their commander, you can cast Mystic Reflection while their commander's still in the stack, and you can target, say, something useless like a mana dork or a token of some kind, and you can make their commander enter as one of those useless things, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So that's really good because we're the commander format, and anything that like stops someone's commander is usually pretty decent. And then on top of that, if you want to play more casually, like this is just really good in really any token strategy deck. Like, I think the best example is like Avenger of Zendikar. Just this card really, really synergizes with Avenger of Zendikar, where like every single token you make off of Avenger becomes another Avenger, and it just gets really stupid really quick. Right?
For sure. And I mean, in those decks, you know, you're already playing two colors. The more and more I think about this card, we've often talked about how there's like the floor and the ceilings of cards. The floor and the ceiling of this card just seems so
high.
Close to each other.
Yeah.
Well, for me, like, the floor is, like, not even, like, that much of a floor. It's like, there's... I mean, like, yeah, your high, I guess, is, you know, getting the Avenger or Zendikar thing to go off. But, like, the floor is, because it's just so low of a CMC, you could tuck this away at any time to then, you know, target someone's commander later on and then be like, alright, that's done. So, yeah.
It's really easy to hold up a single blue mana. It really is.
It really is. No, I think this is going to be... This is definitely going to be something that we see a lot of play in, like, mono blue.
Yeah, I'm going to buy this. I don't know about you. I'm going to buy this card.
Oh, I'm going to buy it, too. Alright, this next one, including, just to give, like, a shout-out to my friend Jesse, because he loves it quite a lot, it's the Icebreaker Kraken. It's 10 blue-blue. It's a snow creature Kraken. Costs one less to cast for each snow land you control. When it enters the battlefield, artifacts and creatures target opponent controls don't untap during that player's next turn. And then, return 3 snow lands you control to their owner's hands. Return Icebreaker Kraken to its owner's hand. And it's an 8/8. So it's just kind of silly, because it's, you know, it's pretty good if you're running this in the right decks where you're going to be blinking it a lot. Like the new Thassa, which is basically another Conjurer's Closet. So those kind of decks, or like Brago, I think. Because it's just kind of a way of like keeping your opponent from doing that much.
So let me ask you guys, is your friend Jesse planning to run all snow basics in his mono blue deck and just hopefully cast this for like 5 mana?
He said that he was going to have to change them. And he was thinking, like, oh, is that going to cost a lot of money? But, you know, Snow Islands right now, if you're buying the ones from Kaldheim, are probably, like, only 30 cents. So just buy 40 of them, and it's going to be, like, not, like, a ton of money, but at least, like, $13, $14. So not bad.
Real quick side note, I think that's kind of been a major topic point about this set, is the fact that there's not really any downside to running snow basic lands, and that's kind of generally perceived as a negative thing because there's just fewer arts. It kind of restricts creativity, and that mono white commander we talked about earlier isn't necessarily enough to like make it so that people don't play their snow basic lands. Do you have anything to add to that?
No, but that is just good to note, because we did talk about how since these are going to be more accessible, we'll likely see more play of snow lands, and I think if you can, just do it.
And for anyone who plays Commander, it's like the only decks that really play snow covered basics are like monocolor decks. You don't really see them in two or three or four or five color decks. Like, you might see a few in like two color decks if they're running like Tainted Pact, but like besides that, it's mostly all like monocolor decks, right?
Yeah, but Tainted Pact too is very specific because it's like you have to run cards of a single name for the most part, so they only include those because it's a better way of like just making sure your mana base is consistent enough without then having to run into the problem of like tap lands. So, you know, you get two forests, one's a normal forest and one's a snow covered forest. But yeah.
So we're gonna move on to the next card, but like I might like continue this conversation we're having here, which is Graven Lore. It is 3 blue-blue snow instant. Scry X, where X is the amount of snow mana spent to cast this spell. Then draw 3 cards. So I initially overlooked this card, but then as I was listening to other people, as I was reading online, it became clear that in terms of mono blue decks, this is just one of the best instant speed draw spells that has ever been printed. And so now, at minimum, mono blue decks are really incentivized to run snow covered basics in order to run this card. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I like how we're coming up with more reasons now to just run snow cards, because really the only reason why we were doing it originally was because of the extra planar lens kind of combo, which surprisingly enough hasn't also like spiked dramatically. It's still sitting around like $30, which is what it's been at for a while.
Wait, it's 30? Last time I checked it was 15. Holy shit. That was like a few years ago though.
Okay, well, a few years ago then. Because it's only had the one printing.
That's true, that's true.
If one non-Kaladesh artifact invention printing, but yeah. No, Graven Lore, though, is pretty good in this kind of scenario. Yeah, there really is no reason not to run, I guess, snows in your monocolor decks just for like these small advantages.
I was just kind of interested in that conversation. Okay. We can move on to black spells for the 99.
Alright, so our first one is Dream Devourer, which is 1 and a black creature demon cleric. Each non-land card in your hand without foretell has foretell. Its foretell cost is equal to its mana cost reduced by 2. Whenever you foretell a card, Dream Devourer gets +2/+0 until end of turn. So, to mention the second ability, whenever you foretell a card, that means whenever you're paying the 2, foretell the card. So it's not when you then cast the card from exile, just to clarify. And I do think that it's kind of interesting that black is the color that's getting the ability to give all your cards foretell. It kind of makes sense, I guess, if you think about it, when you have cards like Praetor's Grasp, Gonti, and the newest opposition agent, where you're casting the cards from exile.
Does it? I was also pretty confused. Like, I can imagine you're a Wizards of the Coast employee, and you come into the office, and you're told, like, hey, some card in this set needs to be able to give every other card foretold. Which color do we put it in? And I'm not sure I really have a good answer.
I would have either said black or red. And I think, you know, we gave red the ability to give every card escape last year, which seems much more red. So it's fine that this is giving all the cards foretell. I don't think it'll see intense amounts of play. I just think that, again, the ability to foretell cards when you're going to be drawing lots of cards and then being able to cast them later for reduced mana cost is pretty important. And even if this leaves the field, you can then still cast those cards that were foretelled.
Oh, you can.
From the foretell. Yes, I read about that in the rules interactions, because I was like really concerned then, like, oh, why would I then foretell a bunch of cards and if this leaves the field? So that's good to know. So, like, just as an example, like, if you foretell expropriate, since it's 7 blue-blue, you foretell for 2, and then it'll cost 5 blue-blue when you want to cast it from exile.
Honestly, like, you know, you and I, we do these set reviews, but, like, most of the time they introduce a new mechanic, and they're not really relevant to Commander, and I'm not saying, like, foretell is super duper important to Commander, but, like, of all the ones I've been introduced to over the last, like, year or two, like, foretell is, like, it might show up every once in a while, right?
Probably.
Maybe. Okay.
Alright, why don't you talk about the next card?
Alright, our next card is Eradicator Valkyrie, 2 black black, creature, angel, berserker, 4/3. With flying, lifelink, and hexproof from planeswalkers. It also has boast for 1 and a black. Sacrifice a creature. Each opponent sacrifices a creature or planeswalker. So this is basically a repeatable fleshbag marauder effect. And I think this is going to see a decent amount of play within the aristocrats archetype, where you're just looking to constantly sacrifice creatures and make your opponents sacrifice creatures, make it so, like, all of your opponents have no creatures, that can never have creatures, and then you just kill them.
I agree, Blake. This will definitely see a lot of play in those kind of decks where you're trying to just get your opponents to sack a bunch of stuff. I'm curious to know what about this made it want to have the hexproof from planeswalkers. It seems very specific, but it doesn't seem like it'll be quite as relevant to us in our format, but we'll see.
Yeah, it's definitely a weird line of text.
Next we have Blood on the Snow. 4 black black, snow sorcery, choose 1, destroy all creatures, or destroy all planeswalkers. Then, return a creature or its planeswalker card with converted mana cost X or less from your graveyard to the battlefield, where X is the amount of snow mana spent to cast a spell. First, the art on this cool is just so damn cool. Like, no pun intended, cool, but it's very metal. It's quite metal. Like, geez. It reminds me a lot of Dead of Winter, which is a card we saw in Modern Horizons. And it does a very similar thing where, like, all non-snow creatures get minus X until end turn, where X is the number of snow permanents you control. And if you think of, like, your typical reanimation spell and then, like, you know, Damnation, I think combining them into one card like this is pretty good. And if you're going to run snow cards to synergize, this will likely be able to grab you the best creature that just died or planeswalker that you just killed from any graveyard. It doesn't also have to be your own, which is pretty nice.
So if I'm reading this card correctly, you can only reanimate a creature that is 6 CMC or less, because you can only put up to 6 mana into this spell, correct?
Correct, but I still think that you're going to have quite a few targets that you could get from it.
Yeah, I agree with that. Alright, the next card we have is Burning Rune Demon. 4, black black, creature, demon, berserker, 6/6, with flying, obviously. Whenever it enters the battlefield, you may search your library for exactly 2 cards not named Burning Rune Demon that have different names. If you do, reveal those cards. An opponent chooses one of them. Put the chosen card into your hand and the other into your graveyard. Then shuffle your library. So, complicated text. Basically, it is another rune scarred demon, but instead of searching for one card, you search for two cards with different names. And ideally, you're playing Commander where, like, the card you search for, you're playing redundant effects. So, like, the two cards you get are basically the same card, and you're forced to be given what you want. This is a card that's really relevant specifically for Kalia Commander decks, because it's a demon. And the reason I really wanted to talk about this card was because I remember when I first started Commander, and it was like within the first month, and I found Runescarred Demon, and I was like, wow, I can't remember how much Runescarred Demon is. I think it's like 7 mana or something, and it's like 7 mana to like tutor from my deck, and also I get like a big body. Wow, this is like the best Magic has to offer, and I love it. And then it wasn't until like later that I'm like, oh wow, Demonic Tutor exists, where I only have to pay like 1 and a black to tutor my library. Holy shit. And I don't know, I just think back to those days when I think Runescarred Demon was like the best tutor in Commander, and I just, it humbles me to think about how far I've come.
Well, that's great, Blake. Alright, next we're gonna move on into red. And we got a spicy card here. It is Tybalt's Trickery, which is 1 in a red. Instant counter target spell. That's a hard target, mind you. Choose 1, 2, or 3 at random. Its controller mills that many cards. It exiles cards from the top of their library until they exile a non-land card with a different name than that spell. They may cast that card without paying its mana cost. Then they put the exiled cards on the bottom of their library in a random order. Oh my god. Now, this is great. Well, okay. The thing about this is, I think this is great in a lot of decks that don't run blue. Because it is a hard counter, and you can kind of think of it like delay. Where delay, like, doesn't necessarily counter, it just suspends the card. But then that card may not be relevant in 3 turns, so it's kind of like you countered it. Where if you are countering something to have someone else then play a different card that they might not have cared about, it's still kind of getting you that benefit.
Right. So there's a lot to be said about this card. I agree with you, like, wow, this card is incredible. Up until now, the only counter spells we've had in red have been like Red Elemental Blast and Pyroblast, but those have only countered specifically blue spells. But this, like you said, counters any target spell, so it's like arguably better. I do want to give a quick shout out to our friend Brayden over on the CDH cast, who loves this card because he can now counter Silence in his Korvold deck. There has been a little bit of concern about whether or not this card is a break in the color pie, because, you know, red doesn't usually counter spells, right? But, you know, if red is ever going to counter a spell, like, it seems very fitting. Like, they've been moving these polymorph effects from blue into red, and that's really what this card does. It, like, counters whatever spell the person is casting and then polymorphs it, right?
Mm-hmm. I think the thing about this and moving the counter into red is it's not like a counter be done with it kind of thing. It's a counter, but you could potentially get the risk of someone getting something better out of it. Like, the funny example that I've seen from, like, Rebel, who was a CDH brewer, was like, oh yeah, I'll use this cast the to counter the Ad Nauseam, but then the person gets to cast, like, Peer into the Abyss. So it's like, oh, yeah, okay, that wasn't really too great for me. But it definitely seems into red's flavor of, like, impulsiveness and gambling. And I think that's what makes it fine. Like, I would just hope we could see more counters in white into the future. That's a different topic. Don't need to, like, delve too much into that right now. We can move on.
Well, I do want to say one more thing about this card, which is I've seen a lot of people confused about the fact that this mills cards, because historically, milling cards is an effect that's only been in blue, right?
And black.
Okay, blue and black. Why are you milling cards in red? I'm confused. Do you want to explain?
You're trying to get around that top deck manipulation that players might have, where oftentimes the most that they can, like, manipulate the top of their deck is three. So, without, like, going through, like, some hoops or hurdles. So you want to try and get the most benefit out of, like, you know, getting them to mill cards that they would, like, purposely want to then try and cast. Or if you want to use this on yourself and you're just like, oh, I'm just going to counter my Llanowar Elves because then I know the next card that I'm going to flip over is going to be, like, I don't know, Peer into the Abyss for some example. They're trying to get around that.
Yeah, it's just to avoid a majority of top deck manipulation cards so that you can't abuse it yourself.
Mm-hmm.
We can move on to the next card, which is Goldspan Dragon, 3 red-red, creature dragon, 4/4 with flying and haste. Whenever Goldspan Dragon attacks or becomes the target of a spell, create a treasure token. And then, treasures you control have tap, sacrifice this artifact, add 2 mana of any one color. So, what this dragon does is it basically doubles your treasure's output. Instead of usually making 1 mana, your treasures will now make 2 mana. So, if your opponent targets this dragon to kill it with a kill spell, for example, it will instantaneously make a treasure, and then that treasure will tap for 2 mana. So, hypothetically, you could then crack the treasure to cast Counterspell to save this dragon. And that's just one example of, like, some really tricky things you can do. So you can be tapped out and you can still make 2 mana of a single color and do some really tricky things. Like, it doesn't have to be your opponent who targets this dragon, it can also be yourself. So you could target it with a card like Expedite and then draw a card. Like, you make the mana off of Expedite to pay for Expedite, and then draw a card, and then just, like, if you have a critical mass of Expedite effects, you could just draw through your entire library. Although, let's be real, unless you're a Zada Hedron Grinder deck, you're probably not doing that. But maybe that's, like, 7 or 9 years in the future. Guy, I wanted to talk with you about this card, about the fact that, you know, Wizards of the Coast seem to be printing more and more cards that generate treasure, and I kind of wanted to have a discussion with you as to whether or not you thought, like, as time moves forward, as more and more cards are created that make treasure, does this card become better and actually, like, super relevant because, like, it is 5 CMC, or does this always remain viewed as a win more kind of card?
I think only time will really tell. For me, my general first impressions are, I don't know. For me, like, whenever I think of, like, a mono red card, I'm only thinking of it in the idea of Purphoros, but, you know, I have to think past that. So then when I start to think about it,
oh,
and, you know, WotC is really trying to push treasures in red, but there were, you know, we already talked about, like, Magda, that one.
Right.
Dwarf woman who creates treasures and then, like, you know, can go tutor stuff.
Yeah. So with this card, you can tutor out your dragons or dwarves at, like, half the cost, right?
Yeah. And also there was the other dragon that really cared about treasures as well last year, I think, of course, at 2021. So I think the more that we go down and the more that they just continue to create treasures, this card will become more relevant and can just really create some explosive plays. I mean, this was Smothering Tide is, like, bonkers.
Oh my God. Boros is OP 2021, am I right?
Oh, you're not wrong. Okay. So let's see. We have one more red card, Dual Strike, which is red-red, instant. When you cast your next instant or sorcery spell with converted mana cost 4 or less this turn, copy that spell. You may choose new targets for the copy. And it has a foretell cost of red. So the most obvious comparison is Fork, which has been spiking in price recently. So if you don't have a Fork, maybe try and pick one up soon. Because it's now sitting around $20, I believe, which is crazy. But the main difference between this and Fork, just for your reference, is that Fork does not create another spell that goes onto the stack. So if someone counters your target that you are using to Fork, then both Fork and that card will fizzle. So let's say you are using Fork to copy, I don't know, like Tybalt's Trickery. It's just the one we just talked about.
Hypothetically.
Yeah, sure. Hypothetically. And so, let's say you use Fork to cast Tybalt's Trickery. So now there's two Tybalt's Trickeries, but if you countered the first Tybalt's Trickery, the target for Fork fizzles, and then Fork fizzles as well, so you can't get the benefit. Now, if you use Dual Strike, you can copy Tybalt's Trickery, and then this will create another one that'll go onto the stack. And so now it doesn't matter whether or not your opponent will counter the first one, you will still get your second one. And I think that's important to note, and why this card is like somewhat more relevant than Fork. So they have their benefits.
Right. I think like they each have their ups and downs, but like, I don't know, as I play Commander more and more, I'm realizing just how many good and powerful instants and sorceries there are that are 4 CMC or less. So as time progresses, I feel like this card just gets more and more powerful, especially considering if you have foretold it and you only need to foretell it for a single red mana.
Yeah. Alright, we're going to move into our last color, which is green.
Alright, we have Tyvar Kell. It is one of the new planeswalkers that has been introduced to the canon. So he is 2 green-green legendary planeswalker Tyvar. And he has a static ability that says elves you control have tap, add black to your mana pool. And he comes in with 3 loyalty, I'll just say that at the beginning. So 4 mana, 3 loyalty. Plus 1. Put a +1/+1 counter on up to one target elf, untap it, it gains death touch until end of turn. 0. Create a 1/1 green elf warrior creature token. -6. You get an emblem with whenever you cast an elf spell, it gains haste until end of turn, and you draw 2 cards. So, the stacked ability basically turns all of your elves into elves of deep shadow, but you don't have to take 1 damage every time they tap, so it's even better. And then he just does generic elf synergy kind of stuff. The emblem, the -6, is pretty good. It's kind of like a glimpse of nature effect, but even better because you're drawing 2 cards per every elf spell you cast. This is the kind of card I personally speaking like to see, where it's like it's a really powerful card, but only in a very specific strategy. This one in particular being elf tribal. Guy, what do you think?
Yeah, in the decks that want to run this, like your elf decks, this card's pretty good. And I think, not that like elf decks are probably running a bunch of doubling season like effects, but like, you know, you get your ultimate to go off pretty quickly with that, in case that's relevant to you. But yeah.
Alright, so this next card is called In Search of Greatness. It is green green enchantment. At the beginning of your upkeep, you may cast a permanent spell from your hand with converted mana cost equal to 1 plus the highest converted mana cost among other permanents you control without paying It's mana cost if you don't scry one. So that's kind of a confusing paragraph of text. Let me just break it down for you. I just need to talk about this card because I think a lot of players are only seeing this in the best case scenario and not viewing this from like the average scenario. So they're like in magical Christmas land, and like this card on its fundamentals is trying to cheat things into play, but it has a whole lot of restrictions. So you have to wait a full turn cycle until your next upkeep to like actually cheat something into play. The permanent has to be exactly 1 plus the highest CMC permanent you control. Like, I think that's the real crux of this card, is the fact that it's not 1 CMC or less. It's the fact that this has to be specifically 1 CMC higher than the permanents you control. And then, so that's really difficult in the first place. And the fact that, like, In Search of Greatness says other permanents you control, so it doesn't even see itself. So, like, you can't just, like, turn one, play a mana dork, turn two, cast In Search of Greatness, turn three, like, cast a three drop, because, like, turn three, it doesn't even see itself. It doesn't see itself as a two drop. You have to, like, at best, you're gonna get a two drop from your elf, right? So, it's not even that great. And so, I hear a lot of people being like, okay, worst case scenario, you're at least scrying one every turn. And I'm like, yeah, you are scrying one every turn. That's really painfully mediocre. Like, unless you're playing like really, really casually, like scrying one every turn is just like painfully mediocre. Like, I think this is only good in specific decks, like maybe like Xenagos God of Revels, where like the deck is used to casting Xenagos and then it's used to like curving out creature after creature after creature, or like maybe Anima. But like after that, there's not many decks that want this card. This card is a trap. Please do not play this card. That being said, if I ever meet you in person and you play In Search of Greatness and you put three creatures in a row off of In Search of Greatness, I will buy you 5 beers, okay? I think that's the highest I've ever gone, okay? Does that make sense? That's how much I think this card, like, I love enchantments, but this card is bad. Do not play this card.
I like how we included the clause, Blake will buy you a beer, into this episode. It seems like it's becoming pretty standard. And I hope when the pandemic's over, Blake, you just go into financial debt and have to buy everyone a beer because of these things that you're saying. I'm not promising that.
Yeah. Dude, this pandemic's gonna be over, and then, like, Command Fest is gonna happen, and, like, then everyone's just gonna flood me and be like, yo, I'm gonna play all these weird cards and, like, beat you with them, and now you owe us, like, 18 beers. I'm like, okay, that's fine. Let's talk about it. Let's have fun.
Yeah, it's gonna be like a loan shark where, you know, they come and they, like, try and beat you up and be like, where's my beer? No. I hope people play this card but then realize how bad it is and then stop playing this card. I hope you learned a lesson. That's all I'm gonna say. Next, we have our last green card, which is Realmwalker, which is 2 to green, creature shapeshifter, has changeling. When it enters the battlefield, choose a creature type. You may look at the top card of your library anytime, and you may cast creature spells of the chosen type from the top of your library. I thought this was fine in just, you know, tribal heavy decks, because it is pretty low CMC and it gives you that kind of like Oracle of Moldiah thing where you can then play the top card if it is, you know, of the card that you want to play. But in general, like, you know, it's fine.
I remember we just recently got Conspicuous Snoop, and like at least Snoop enabled certain types of combos because there's just been so many good goblins printed over the years. But with Realm Walker, yes, it's good, but it doesn't actually lead to any sort of, like, combo win. It's just sort of, like, generic good synergy amongst tribal decks that have green in their commander color identity. Yeah?
Yeah. This is, I guess, like a generic, okay, conspicuous snoops for decks. I don't know. It's just fine. I think it'll see some play in those kind of decks that could run green.
Okay.
Alright, we got our two Planeswalkers that we're going to talk about. I'm going to talk about this one because I like it a lot and Blake got to talk about two cards in a row, so I'm going to take this. We have Kaya, the Inexorable. 3 white-black, legendary Planeswalker, Kaya. +1, put a ghost form counter on up to one target non-token creature. It gains, when this creature dies, or is put into exile, return it to the owner's hand, and create a +1/+1 white spirit creature token with flying. -3, exile target non-land permanent. And -7, you get an emblem with, at the beginning of your upkeep, you may cast a legendary spell from your hand, from your graveyard, or from among cards you own in exile without paying its mana costs. And she enters with 5 loyalty. So normally we don't talk too much about Planeswalkers, but all of them have had quite a nice relevance in this set. I think Kaya's +1 is great protection for your commander specifically, since it comes back to the hand and you can circumvent the commander text that way, and you'll get a body out of it. It only takes 3 turns to get to the ultimate, and in a Planeswalker Super Sphinx deck, that won't be too hard, and then she could stick around. Plus, you'll then be able to cast legendary spells from your hand, which all Planeswalkers are, so that'll be pretty nice. So, yeah, I think she's pretty good and can see quite a bit of play. That exile target non-land permanent, too, can come in handy in quite a pinch.
I pretty much agree with you, Guy, although I do have one small critique about this card. It's the fact that, like, Mark Rosewater and I both really dislike the ultimate, being able to cast spells from exile. We don't like the fact that this card can cast cards from the exile zone without having put them there in the first place. Because, I don't know about you, but, like, you and I both left Yu-Gi-Oh! Around 2015, and when that happened, like, the exile zone, aka the banished zone in terms of Yu-Gi-Oh! Terms, and the graveyard very much felt like they might as well be the same zone. Like, there's not much of a difference, and I feel like those two zones merging is a bad thing for the game.
I don't mind it here specifically because the emblem is kind of a little bit of work to get to, unless if you are playing in the doubling season Boren Klecks way of being able to ultimate right away. I know that, like, that's kind of like one of Black's things, though, where you can then cast cards from exile. And since it's kind of the only color that's been able to do it consistently, that's okay with me. But I would not want to see this kind of ability being pushed into many other colors, at least.
Alright, we'll talk about the next Planeswalker, Nico Aris. They cost X, white, blue, blue, legendary Planeswalker Nico, and they have 3 loyalty. Whenever Nico enters the battlefield, create X shard tokens. They're enchantments with 2, sacrifice this enchantment, scry 1, then draw a card. And then they have some loyalty abilities, and so up to 1 target creature you control can't be blocked this turn. Whenever that creature deals damage this turn, return it to its owner's hand. -1, Nico Aris deals 2 damage to target tapped creature for each card you've drawn this turn, and then -1, create a shard token.
I think the 2 most noteworthy things is first, non-binary Planeswalker, where it is relevant to their story and character. It's not just like they're doing that for the sake of, like, hey, look what we did. They're making it relevant. And the X is great because you don't need to dump mana when you cast Nico. but if you do, you get a bunch of enchantment tokens, which are great for those enchantress effects that Blake loves. And then they synergize very well with the minus one, where you can then likely kill any target, and then because ETB enchantress effects will shards enter, enchantress will then draw you a bunch of cards, you do the minus one, deals 2 damage to target tapped creature for each card you draw on, so then you can probably kill most things.
Alright, so I like this card on some dimensions, but like in terms of like actually playing this card, it is similar to like Nissa, Steward of Elements, in the terms of like it enters the battlefield based on how much X mana you spend to cast it. However, like the first time, like this is the first time you're seeing like a token enchantment besides like masks from like Estrid. This is the main problem I have with this card, is that there's not really a home for it. Like, there's banned enchantress decks. However, like the best thing you could possibly do in banned enchantress with this card is you can trigger constellation effects. So you could trigger a whole bunch of like Doomwaker Giants effects, or you could cast this, make a whole bunch of shard tokens, tap Sarah's Sanctum to add a whole bunch of mana, and then like sacrifice the shard tokens to draw a bunch of cards. But like that's just like painfully mediocre. Like as much as I like Nico, it doesn't really have a home.
I guess in casual Bant decks, Nico will probably see play, but it does seem like you have to build a very specific environment to get the most play from Nico, or the most benefits, I guess. Alright, next we have our colorless artifacts and lands. We got four more. So, Pyre of Heroes, 2, artifact. 2 mana, tap, sacrifice a creature. Search your library for a creature card that shares a creature type with the sacrificed creature and has converted mana cost equal to 1, plus that creature's converted mana cost. Put that card onto the battlefield, then shuffle your library. Activate this ability only time you could cast a sorcery. So, obviously this is like Birthing Pod. It's kind of meh.
I think the main crux of this card, because this was one of the first cards spoiled of this set, however, the fact that it's restricted to a certain creature type makes it just like infinitely worse than Birthing Pod. Like Birthing Pod is like breakable, but like the fact that this is restricted to a certain creature type just like makes this like I was considering buying this, but I'm like no.
No, it does seem like in order to get the best benefit out of it, you do need other combo pieces. Like you'd probably want like Arcane Adaptation or Conspiracy, where you're making all.
That's just like too much work. That's just too much work.
Yeah, it doesn't seem like it's as easy of a setup. So let's move on. What's next?
All right, we have Weathered Runestone for 2 colorless mana. It's an artifact that says non-land permanent cards in graveyards and libraries can't enter the battlefield. Players can't cast spells from graveyards or libraries.
Can't cast spells from graveyards or libraries is pretty important. Non-land permanent cards in graveyards and libraries can't enter the battlefield as well. It's a nice hose.
The closest comparison to any other card would be Grafdigger's Cage. But here's the issue I have, is the fact that like even though this stops any non-land permanent, not just creatures, which makes this technically better than Grafdigger's Cage, like I don't actually expect to see this card much, because like the only time we saw Grafdigger's Cage was like in CDH, and that was only during the time in which both Flash and Protean Hulk were legal in the format, which since earlier in 2020, like that hasn't been legal. So like I don't actually know how many decks are actually gonna play this card, like unless you just like have a super hate boner and want to screw over every single graveyard strategy deck. Like I don't actually see this like seeing a bunch of play.
I agree.
Alright, we have Maskwood Nexus, which is 4 mana, artifact. Creatures you control are every creature type. Alright. And the same is true for creature spells you control and creature cards you own that aren't on the battlefield. And then for 3, tap, create a 2/2 blue shapeshifter creature token with changeling. Alright. So, this is a good, probably budget alternative for some of those cards that we've mentioned before that'll make all your creatures a certain type. So, redundancy there is nice.
I feel like the closest comparison to other cards would be like Conspiracy, Xenograph, and Arcane Adaptation. Cards that really care about manipulating the creature type of every single creature card you cast. This just like adds among them and it can go in any deck because it's colorless. And I feel like a whole bunch of casual minded people who just want to do really silly stuff want to use this card. It's kind of hard to use as a combo piece.
Yeah, the one biggest upside to this would just be that it is a budget-friendly alternative. But other than that, it's just fine. So, we got one more card. Blake, why don't you do the honors?
Alright, so our last card is the World Tree. It is a land that says, the World Tree enters the battlefield tapped, add green to your mana pool. As long as you control 6 or more lands you control have tap, add 1 mana of any color. And then it has an activated ability of 2 white, 2 blue, 2 black, 2 red, 2 green, tap. Sacrifice the World Tree. Search your library for any number of god cards, put them onto the battlefield, then shuffle your library. So this is pretty insane. First off, that last ability of putting like every single god from your deck onto the field is pretty crazy. We don't see that kind of thing very often. It really incentivizes you to build god tribal and just use the activated ability as a way to just like overwhelm your opponents in terms of like board presence and card advantage and just win the game, hopefully. So if you're playing casually, that's a great way to win. Otherwise, like, people may disagree with me on this, but like I actually feel like the best thing about this card is the fact that it says as long as you control 6 or more lands you control have add 1 mana of any color. So as long as this card is relatively affordable, like I don't have to pay more than $5 for this, like I feel like this is actually a great way to build 5 color commander decks that will be able to like fix for any color of mana I need after a certain point in the game, after like turn 6 or whatever, right?
No, I totally agree, because it's also nice that it says 6 or more lands you control. It's not now just excluding you to basics as well. So it's just making all your lands have that generic tap for any one color. And I do think that this could become a nice, easy staple into those Wooburg decks that sometimes have hard times of like picking out lands to run that aren't, you know, the dual lands, like the best, the original dual lands. So this is pretty good, and I feel like you could just pretty much ignore that white, blue, blue, black, red, green, green kind of text, because, you know, that is relevant to the god decks, but like you're probably more likely to just run this in Wooburg decks for the color fixing.
So I think like one of the main things talked about this card is the fact that like it's not a legendary, and WotC has made a few statements about that. I'm not necessarily sure that like the player base is really satisfied with their answers. Honestly, I don't know. I feel like I'm kind of caught in the middle about this.
I'm not going to lose sleep over it, because it seems like for us in terms of like Commander, it doesn't matter so much because, you know, we'd only have one copy of this in general. I know that they tend not to do legendary lands as much because of that downside of you know, once you play the one legendary land, then you're not going to be able to play another legendary land because you'd have to sacrifice it. Their reasoning seems to be like kind of like pick and choose for what is legendary when it comes to those kind of cards. Because I remember there being like an issue with another card that was or was not legendary, and they had like the opposite reason for like why then this isn't legendary, so it's weird. I'm not gonna lose sleep about it, like I said. Doesn't matter to me, but it is just like, whatever. It's good for us, though.
Yeah, I think like the one last comment I have to say about this card is the fact that like all God tribal decks, which have existed for a while, people have tried to put them into various five color decks. Like, now all of a sudden, Golos is going to be the best God commander deck because Golos is going to enter the battlefield, he's going to search up the world tree, then maybe one or two or three turns later, you're going to tap the world tree and get out every single god you have from your deck onto the battlefield. And I'm kind of sad about that because it is going to homogenize the format to a certain extent.
Hmm. That is a good point. Alright, so we've gone over all the cards that we think are relevant for the 99 at least. So, what do we think the best new 99 card is? Well, for me, I think Mystic Reflection is just the best card in terms of like its highs and lows. You can really use it however you want, and it being such a low mana cost, it's going to have very little downside to you. Tybalt's Trickery is also very good because of it being a hard counter, and again, it's just versatile because you can use it on yourself as well. I will say that that probably won't see as much play in like decks that aren't running blue because your options of counterspells are just going to be much better. But if you need the protection, I would recommend this card. And then I think just the last one in general that I would probably want people to run is the World Tree for Wooburg decks specifically because of how well it can just give all your lands the ability to tap for any color. I think that that's going to actually be a lot more relevant.
Like, if it costs less than $5, like, maybe consider buying it.
Yeah, I would just pick one up now just to be safe in case of, like, you know, we get down the road in a year and, you know, it spikes, kind of like how the Great Henge has recently spiked and is now is like a $50 card.
Yeah. In terms of the best 99 guy, I feel like you and I are in the same boat. Like, for me, personally, Tybalt's Trickery is one of the best cards because it's something that gives mono red an ability it never has had access to, being able to counter a target spell. And even decks outside of mono red but don't have access to blue, this, I know I've argued with a few of our friends over Discourse, but like I really would advise them to just like play this card. Yes, it risks the polymorph effect, but like most of the time it's going to be beneficial for you and it's worth running.
Yeah, I agree.
Alright, any final thoughts you have?
I think that the payoff for waiting so long for a Viking-themed set really shows. They definitely tried to cram as much as they could into this, and I hope that we see a return to this set so we can explore even more. It seems like it has a lot to offer because of all the different realms there are. There's the gods. The modal double face cards are pretty relevant here. So, very interesting. Good start. We got some cards that we'll likely see play. I mean, last year, if we compare it, I guess, to Theros, we had two of the strongest cards to just come off right off the bat. But this one seems like there's, you know, strong cards more evenly across all the colors. It's pretty nice. I don't feel like I'm going to throw up.
I just kind of asked because there has been a lot of discourse around the typical, oh, white is bad, white is terrible. And I'm kind of concerned about the communication breakdown between the player base and employees of Wizards of the Coast, because as spoiler season went on, white cards were revealed, people weren't very happy, and people kind of harassed the color ambassador on the Council of Colors, that being Ari. And he left Twitter. He just straight up left Twitter because he was like tired of the harassment. And I don't know, coming from like Yu-Gi-Oh! And almost any other trading card game, WotC is like the only company who's willing to actually like talk to the player base about their decisions in terms of like making cards and like their thought process behind making cards. And I am concerned like Ari might not have like thick skin compared to like Mark Rosewater in terms of like harsh criticism. And I don't know, I just like, I want everyone to be happy. Come on, man. I just want everyone to be happy.
Yeah, I agree. I think, you know, the one downside to, you know, players being able to just communicate directly with WotC employees is oftentimes that they will communicate their displeasements with the wrong people, and that can sometimes be a little overwhelming. But, you know, some of them have just kind of like, you know, been like, eh, they know what to do, and just pass the information along to the right person. But, you know, the best way to, like, start conversations like that when you're, like, trying to say, like, you know, I'm not satisfied with this is don't attack the person, obviously. You want to try and create the discussion of, hey, I noticed this, but why is this the way it is? And then you can, like, you know, go off from there instead of just being like, you're stupid and this sucks, I'm mad,
I'm blaming you personally.
Right, you are not going to get nearly as good of a response, and you're not nearly going to get as good of a conversation that comes out of that, because then the person becomes very defensive and just starts to explain like why you're then wrong, and then you get mad, and it just kind of escalates from there. Alright, so that was Call Time. Both part one, you can listen to where we talk about all the legendary creatures, and now we've just gone over all the cards that we thought were relevant for the 99. So, thank you very much for listening. We are the Wizard Soft Podcast. You can listen to us on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, YouTube, and anywhere else you listen to your podcasts. Make sure you leave a like and review. You can follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at WizardStaff101. Send us an email at wizardstaff101@gmail.com if you want to bitch and complain about how stupid we are. Thank you for listening, and we hope you have a great night. Peace.
Peace.